The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Book Club. I'm Claire Armistead, books editor for The Guardian and Observer. This month's guest is Robert McFarlane, who joined us to talk about his book, The Old Ways, in which he walks all sorts of ancient footpaths in England, Scotland, Spain, China, and Palestine. It's his third about landscape and the human mind, making him the laureate of perambulatory literature, according to book club host John Mullen. He's particularly brilliant at recording exact scenes and experiences, even when they took place in the dark. So how, Mullen asked, does he do it?
There's a paradox at the heart of any writing like this, just as there is at any talking about writing like this, which is that we tend to do it indoors, but the experience is an exterior one. I'm fascinated by the ways in which images, metaphors, tropes, dreams move between exterior and interior, between landscape and spirit. So there are all sorts of changes of domain that fascinate me, but one of them is the move indoors to write about the outside. And notebooks are there, but it's impossible. There's no point in wandering along with a blue pencil behind the ear and the moleskin in the hand, because you never see past the bookmark. And there has to be... Walking is about opportunity, encounter, happenstance, accident, the fall of light. So a long time ago, actually, I tried as much as I could to just put the notebook away, and it would only come out at the very end of the day, and then I would just throw down fragments and cairns, as it were, that could then sort of mark the way back at the end of a time walking or climbing or whatever it was I was doing. So fragments and flashes, sometimes single words, terrible sketches, which my toes curl to look back. Every now and then there'll be an artist and I'll be talking to them. I say, oh, look, you said, I did this little... expecting them to say something kind and emollient, but they just look bewildered and slightly embarrassed. So I've stopped doing that now. Yes, so the notebook is a set of seed crystals, if you like, which might begin the precipitation afterwards.
So you do it so it's when you're in the tent or in your sleeping bag or...
Yeah, yes. I guess so. And then at the very end, when I'm home, I'll sit down and just pour thoughts and fragments down and try and get as much as I can from the memory. And that will come out in disorder. Right. And then there'll be a slightly... sort of twisting the kaleidoscope to see how the patterns emerge afterwards.
Do you train your memory?
I don't have a very good memory for language, which is a slight disadvantage given that my day job is, like yours, teaching literature. And I have a friend who you know, is one of these friends who can do two packs of cards and has most of Shakespeare by heart, and I don't hang out with him so much anymore. But the visual image, and very often the isolated image, almost the circle at the end of the binocular, as it were, just does stay. Sometimes I try and set mnemonics going in my brain to remember the blackbird and the this and the that, because walking is both sequential and then it curl the cues back on itself in all sorts of odd ways. And the only other thing I'd say about the visual is that at the very end of the 5 years I spent walking very intermittently for this book, strange patterns began to emerge in retrospect and little echoes and reprises of, for example, the glowing eyes and what I write about, the tapetum lucidum, which is the retinal skin at the back of animals' eyes, which returns light back through the eye so that they effectively see twice, make twice the use of the available light, which is what gives them that gorgeous glow. That's cat's eyes. That's the technological basis of cat's eyes. I began to realize that I had seen these glowing eyes, versions of them, rhymes with them throughout my journeys. And so these patterns emerge in retrospect as well as in the forwards course of walking.
You're quite often walking with other people.
Well, this book is filled with people.
Yes.
And filled with folk I was with, and that's, I mean, it's wonderful there to have them there. The thing I have most of, I'd have no difficulty remembering what we've seen, but I do have difficulty remembering what was said.
Yes.
And there are people like, some of you will know the work of John McPhee or Joseph Mitchell, New Yorker writers. And Mitchell, who was fascinated by what he called the yabber and the jib-jab, the kind of common speech, as it were. He wanted to let his people talk. He's barely there. He's just prompting this and that. But some of his subjects speak for four pages. I mean, yes. There are transcriptions of four pages. I mean, I guess he had a dictaphone in the 40s. I don't know. But Truman Capote, famously, for In Cold Blood, he had this is the Capote memory, that he can remember speech as though as though it's unfurling in front of him at the time he writes. I can't do that. And speech is the one thing where I do reach for the notebook afterwards and try and get down what I can, and then I'll show it. All the people who've written about here were sent their chapters, as it were. That's a very uneasy time for a writer. And I'm going through it at the moment again. And you wait nervously for the response as your subject, as it were. Although they're very often friends, companions, dear friends. Nevertheless, it's an odd thing being written about.
Yes. Did you know you were going to write about these journeys when you made them?
Well, it's something I've written a little about in the article for the newspaper about the book club, and it was an odd thing because I was asked to write an article more or less about how the book came into being, and that caused me to go back to the very first notebooks from 2006, and there you find yourself a stranger. I mean, one's voice feels odd when you hear it back on a recording from a day ago or the afternoon, but when you meet yourself 8 years earlier, it's a very strange being indeed. And and I realised that the book was emerging very naturally out of the last book that I had written, that it was there. I've called them kind of cairns again, or little signposts, a little single line saying, think about this, go to this place, take Schiller with you. Huh? And out of that thinking, I mean, I write my books very, very slowly, so it isn't as though, you know, a commission is struck and the book is written. This is the only way I know is to allow them to fall into their own patterns as they go, and sometimes that's by chance and sometimes that's by looking and devising, but that's the hope, is that they will find their own strange form. So the book I'm writing now, which will take me another 4 years, about underlands, I already know is going to effectively be structured according to a subterranean logic, and subterranea is fascinating because its entrances are visible to you and its exits are visible to you, but all the other is lost. This book naturally took the form of crossing paths. It's full of literal crossroads and path crossings, but I also wanted to weave that into the structure of the book and allow, as it were, image to cross and set trails and paths going. So I hope the experience of reading it is either confusion and bewilderment at the Garden of Forking Paths and annoyance. Actually, I don't hope it's that. That's a possible outcome. Or that a sense that you are entering into a network, as I did, a network of fabulous intersecting pathways, which effectively covers the world.
Almost every person in Who's Who had put walking as one of their things. Yeah. And it feels like you're tapping into something that, you know, has become, maybe in the last century or something, an almost universal recreation, but maybe therapeutic activity.
Gosh, well, as a 18th, 19th centuryist, you'll know much better than I how walking emerges almost as recreation. Having been stigmatized through 16th, 17th centuries, broadly speaking, as a kind of the chivalric is the rider, and the pedestrian is down in the dusty thoroughfare, and then this conversion of image occurs, whereby walking becomes a way in. And Romanticism is obviously deeply involved in that, and we are living through another version of that now. But walking is also our oldest form of motion. And I say at one point in the book that the breath and the footfall are our kind of three oldest rhythms as a species. And so we've always walked instrumentally. Recreationally, it's fascinating to speculate and impossible to know, but people have always thought while walking. So it's hardly a new invention, as it were, but very interesting. And you know, the literature of the leg, walking and writing, is ancient and unites very naturally, falls into step with travel writing, which goes back to the Epic of Gilgamesh. So we've been walking about writing and thinking while walking for as long as we know.
I'm not projecting onto you here, Robert, but it is striking that you don't say this about Wordsworth, but you say about several of the other great walkers. Mm. Oh, like lots of walkers, here's a depressive. Mm.
I'm a pretty cheery person, and walking generally makes me feel good, except after about 30 miles when the hip click begins and the blisters bud. But the black dog tags along at the heels of a lot of walkers, and one of the reasons Thomas walked was to shake it off, to leave it behind, see if he could outstride it. Burrow calls it the horrors, his depression, which, and he capitalizes it. And I still, whenever I meet that word used by Burrow, I get a terrible sense of how tormented he was by the horrors. And he walked to try and leave the horrors behind, I think. And Thomas was tormented by this dual longing, one that I think we all experience to some degree now, which is to put down root and to keep moving, to dwell and to roam. And he was really torn apart by the double irreconcilable compulsion of that. Eventually it sent him to war, where he was killed by a shell on the first day of the Battle of Arras. But a very long time ago, a very good writer about mountains called Ed Douglas said to me, walking's just cheap psychotherapy. And he's a gruff guy, and he's fascinated by imagination but doesn't brook romanticism. And that's always stuck with me. And I think it's many more things besides and many less things besides. But Burrow, Thomas, there are many other examples. And many people are cured. Others, Thomas again, it doesn't work for them. Doesn't always work for them. So it's no cheap fix for sadness, but many people have tried it.
The way you write, the thing I think I like most about it is just actually the words. You say you haven't got a linguistic memory, but it's a book full of funny words, kind of Scrabble words.
Scrabble words, yes.
Yes, yabba. I can really use yabba sometime.
Yeah.
What are Zawns? Z-A-W-N-S?
I feel like turning this into a pub quiz, but Zawn is southwestern, particularly Cornish term for a sort of gap in the cliffs, often kind of wave crashed cliff gorge, effectively. And anyone who's been to Anglesey and climbed there will know there's a very famous set of rock climbs that go over a huge zorn on Anglesey. One of them is beautifully called Dream of White Horses, which is an E25B that teeters out over this zorn. Zorn's really, as a word, it has gravity. It sucks you down.
Right.
I relish words, and the book I'm just finishing now is a book partly of glossaries of place words and thousands of incredibly rich lexis for landscape.
So it feels like you're collecting words as you go out.
One of the people you meet in this book is Finlay MacLeod, and Anne Campbell, these wonderful people I'll be up seeing again in October on the Isle of Lewis, and they'd constructed a peat glossary, which was a glossary of the terms used for the specifics of moor and peat just in three townships in the northwest of the Isle of Lewis, and it ran to 140 to 60 words, beautiful in their precision and their poetry. And I collect collectors, I obsess about obsessives, and I love specialists in anything. And for a long time, the language of geology has been particularly tactile to me. The book is divided into substances. Mm. The chapters are substance types, and that's partly because I'm fascinated by how we're brought to think differently and feel differently and be differently by the surfaces and the substances and the textures of the world we inhabit and move through. And of course, geology is thick in that, and the language thrills me. But I'm also interested in how metaphors migrate from specialisms into spirit, as it were. I couldn't help, when I was talking on the West Bank with a geologist who just filled his notebooks with drawings, and he was talking about aquifers and springs and anticlines, and there we were sitting in the middle of a disputed territory, watching the language of hard stone move unconsciously into the language of politics and hope and relation. That this fascinates me.
That chapter on the West Bank seemed to have quite a powerful kind of use, because walking is not a sort of a natural right, actually.
Yes.
Walking is not natural. Walking has to be permitted.
There is a detail which I deliberately left in the Lewis and Harris book, which is I had to call, because it's deer stalking country. You're passing, as you probably know, through a Scottish forest, which is to say a treeless forest, because forest designates a hunting domain rather than a kind of arboreal landscape. And access is there because of the revision of the Scottish access rights, which I'm very pro, but you still have to call to make sure you're not going to get shot. And at Loch Rayshort, which is deep in the sort of Lewis-Harris borderlands, the estates leave, in this case, I think it was a young Polish couple, and they give them a spotter's scope. This is in the middle of absolutely nowhere, and they spot for salmon poachers, effectively, salmon fishermen, and anyone who might be disturbing the deer. I came into the middle of nowhere. There was a structure. I'd been walking, for a day by that point, and this really is pretty. There's eagles all overhead, seagulls and golden eagles, and I was heading for these beehive sheilings, and I saw this flash. It's like a moment in a Buchan novel. And I realized it was the sun winking off a spyglass. and that I was being checked out by this distant watcher who I later kind of understood was, that's what I asked Steve Dilworth when I got there. He said, oh yeah, they have the watchers in place and the little huts. They live there, you know, during the game seasons. And even there, in this most astoundingly, thrillingly open of landscapes, you were being watched.
The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When you need to know what's in the news, you turn to The Guardian. When you want to create something newsworthy, you turn to Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. Getting started takes only seconds. Just go to squarespace.com, and to support this podcast, use the offer code GUARDIAN to take 10% off.
One of the things, of course, which, I mean, characterizes the way you write is your similes, really. Your similes. And you must be conscious of it. Here's one, okay? These are seals in Stornoway Harbour.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah? Their blubbery backs looking like the puffed-up anoraks of murder victims. This is one Jan Morris said. Can puffin wings really sound like the whirring of banknote counting machines? She loved the book apart from that.
Get yourself to a puffinry is all I can say to that. And a bank as well, because you need both sides of the simile. But, well, starlings are simile makers, because they're one of these amazing species that can almost mimic, they internalise and pick up fragments of sound.
Yeah.
And so they are actually almost like urban sampling machines and simile makers. So I needed something urban to catch their rip-rap. No, I am fascinated by exactitude, and you quite rightly sort of pointed out in your article about the book that, you know, for some people this means a very foreign experience, very strange experience. J.A. Baker, The Peregrine, vital book for me, he famously has the simile of a blackbird looking like a mad Puritan with a banana balanced on its nose, on his nose. I sort of thought, if I ever achieve that level of specificity, I'll know I've made it.
Well, you did the grebe tufted like Ziggy Stardust. You use some similes which are precise, but
incomprehensible.
Well, yes. You'd have to go away. What does dark as Mafic glass mean?
Yeah,
you know, you go and look it up. Or what does light candle blacking dropped into water? Well, I'm sure we're sitting in a room of people who all are very well acquainted with Mafic glass. But it's past the time probably where I should give everybody here a chance to ask.
It's about people of note, people who've done something of note, saying that they are walkers. I know loads of people who don't walk, who aren't in Who's Who. Do you think that walking and being of note in some way go together?
Gosh, well, it's the most everyday practice. And one of the things I suspected and discovered in the course of writing this book is that it's how countless people make sense of themselves, find direction, brief encounters with the surprising or the beautiful. I'm fascinated by the everyday folk I met, and so I think one of the surest ways to crush a walk into a sort of coal-like certitude is to intend something for it, is to go out and walk with a capital W. But actually some of the most interesting people I met up on the hill, Ivanhoe Beacon, people just coming at the end of the day to walk up to the top of that hill and see the sun on a Friday evening full in their face from a high point. These seem to me like kinds of congregation, secular worships, little rituals that were undertaken, and they fascinated me as much as the people I encountered who were artists or people of note in their own fields.
I'm an NHS podiatrist working with homeless people in central London, so I particularly found your description of homeless walkers that you met along your ways very interesting. And I also really enjoyed your descriptions of walking barefoot as a podiatrist, so I wondered, do you still walk barefoot?
I'll be off to the beach, which is where we all walk barefoot in Dorset next week. I don't much anymore. It was about 2 years when I was just fascinated by how differently the world felt and indeed looked. If one of the epigraphs from the book is from Nan Shepherd, wonderful Scottish writer, who says, "My eyes were in my feet." And I love the thought of us seeing through our bodies and through our souls in that sense. Yes, one of my friends walked deliberately through a patch of nettles, like chili for the feet, he said, but I didn't follow him. As to homelessness, well, particularly when it's chosen, it's a radical state and one I could never tolerate, come anywhere close to. But I did meet one man on the South Downs, you probably read, who just had gone through some trauma and then just set off walking, and he just did not have a home. I think this happens a lot more in America, where the sort of trail, long-distance trail culture is very developed. People have trail handles, which they're known by, and that becomes almost their identity. Their peripatetic self becomes everything.
Robert, you're the most poetic of writers, and yet you write in prose. You're a great admirer of Edward Thomas. When is your prose going to turn into poetry?
It's a great question, and Thomas is fascinating for that. I mean, I think Frost famously likens finding the poems in the strata of the prose to a sort of prizing out of fossils, and you realise that the prose has been the geological context within which these poems could actually form, and that fascinates me, that Thomas wrote millions of words of prose and 142 poems, but the poems had to emerge out of that prose, as it were. But it's a wonderful and justly famous story. I'm fascinated by writers who move between Michael Ondaatje, Anne Michaels, two Canadian poets who became brilliant novelists as well, and you can see the relations. In my case, never is the short answer. I'll never write a novel and I'll never write poems. I'll never write a novel because I've read too many of them, and I'll never write a poem again because I have already. Yeah, they occasionally surface. I published a volume called, I was one of four poets. It was called Four Poets. 200 of them were printed. Every now and then one appears. Where I can, I buy it back off the person who owns it and destroy it. But poetry from when I really should have known better. I think actually writing bad poetry trained me to write kind of, you know, medium good prose, if you like, but it's not going to go the other way.
One of the most endearing experiences you write about to me was where you stride out of your house and up the chalk slope and into the wood until you get to the observatory. And you describe how you can sit up in the observatory, completely invisible to the walkers below. And do you still do this, and what inspiration do you get from it?
Well, I should explain that the observatory is a tree, is a beech tree. So I, for a long time, well, I go up to the beechwoods all the time, and still amazing things happen. The day I left to look at J.A. Baker's archive in Essex about his writing of The Peregrine in the 60s, that morning I went up to the woods, and near that tree, a peregrine came over, hunted pigeons dramatically over the alfalfa, over the oilseed rape field that runs down from the wood, and just astonished me. And so this tiny little wood filled with condoms and hypodermics and doggers and at different times of day and night and happy walkers and all the rest of wood life knocked me over yet again. So I'm still amazed by it. I do still climb the tree, not nearly as often as I did. It is wonderful, especially when they're in leaf like now. And if you do climb a tree, people will not see you, because, as I say at the beginning of the book, people don't expect to see grown men in trees.
Do you take any delight in walking in cities? Or are they not old enough?
Well, increasingly, and to my fascination, I feel illiterate in a city, which is strange because it's such a textual environment. But this evening I enjoyed a wonderful walk along the towpath with a great poet called Stephen Watts. I love walking with people who can read cities and know cities. And I am increasingly writing about them. I'm sort of moving in via the edgelands into... So I've been writing about the Parisian catacombs. Been down in those for a good number of days. And I'm really looking forward to writing about infrastructure and fibre optics and... masonry and absent volume and how cities are built out of their own bellies.
Do you mind being underground? Do you panic at all, or are you quite happy about it?
No, I'm fascinated by it. It's very, very interesting to me. And what is very interesting to me is how powerful talking about being underground is. People really start to edge away from you or kind of curl their bodies up. But I mean, that to me means that there is an astonishing subject to be written about there, that even the imagination of such space, confined space, can cause people's bodies to curl, let alone the vast culture of death, burial, underworlds. I do not know a culture that does not involve, that does not have an underworld as part of its mythic structure.
What happened up at Chanctonbury, the ring?
Yeah.
I've asked you before on this, but what do you understand by the word ghost?
There is an encounter on the South Downs. I spent the night in Chanctonbury Ring because it seemed like a nice place to sleep, High Point, shelter, beautiful, strange place. Didn't know anything about its history. Turned up at Chanctonbury Ring and was woken. It's quite a lonely place if you've been there, because actually the downs fall away on either side and the city lights seem quite distant, although you're in the south of England. And then I was woken by screaming, and the screaming was, to my ear, very human, quite childlike, and it was coming from 30 feet up in the tree ring that I was sleeping within. And then the screaming split into two sources of screaming and began to sort of move around the ring towards the pointer, as it were, on the clock face where I was sleeping, and it seemed, or not sleeping by this point, seemed that they were the sounds were going to converge. It was really very, very scary moment, and I did what any sensible person would do, which is wriggled as far down into my sleeping bag as I possibly could and hoped the noises would stop, which they more or less did when they kind of joined overhead, screamed for a while, and then they stopped. And the rational explanation is, of course, I have slowly pieced together afterwards, that they were probably short-eared or little owls. They were certainly not tawnies or barns or any. I mean, I excluded all sorts of things that they might be. The weird thing is that when I then got back and looked up Chanctonbury Ring, I discovered that there had been many similar experiences at Chanctonbury Ring of this kind of noise, and indeed that a gang of hairy bikers in 1966 had trucked up there on their Harleys, got lagered up, and then been totally freaked out and fled. So I did at least feel, you know, I'd done all right on that front, even if my own kind of cowardice had been immobility. But
it feels as though you're always moving forward and finding somewhere new to walk or experience. And I've just got a simple question, whether there's a place or a Zenotopia that, as and when you've got some breathing space, that you feel compelled to go back and revisit, and if so, why?
I can't stay away from the Cairngorms, so that probably doesn't fall into your category of revisiting, because I'm there very often and have been for years. But I think I can say this without, in the best sense, the BBC were very keen on filming The Old Ways as a three times one hour series. And in the end, I just couldn't do it, because the thought of everything here happened in the way it happened, and the thought of then going back to the places and trying to make it happen again was completely sort of dispiriting. And so I didn't do it. I think going back with a film crew is very different to going back with them on your own. And I will be going back up to the Outer Hebrides. I'll see Ian Stephen, I'll see Steve Dilworth, and I can't wait to see them, but and to see Lewis and Harris with them again. So I think probably the Outer Hebrides, yeah.
We found out, really kind of unsurprisingly, depressingly, that for me, that not only does Robert write wonderful, brilliant, readable books, but he's also an academic who's turned down a three-part TV series. I mean, good on you, but...
Well, thank you. And thank you.
And thank you all very much for your question. I'm sorry anybody who didn't get a chance to ask your question, but thanks very much for coming and for asking your questions. And I'm sure you'd want me to thank Robert very much for answering them.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When you need to know what's in the news, you turn to The Guardian. When you want to create something newsworthy, you turn to Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. Getting started takes only seconds. Just go to squarespace.com, and to support this podcast, use the offer code GUARDIAN to take 10% off.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.